Jewish audio on Kabod.org.
So we're going to talk about darkness tonight. Specifically, the darkness of the ninth plague, the plague of Choshech. It's a given for most of us that there are 10 plagues, and we know exactly what the 10 plagues are, because we always sit at the Seder night, and we heard the story since we're little children, and we know how to enumerate it, and we know exactly what the plagues are, and we more or less have descriptive terms. So make believe you didn't know all that. Make believe you didn't know all that. And we're going to take a look in the second book of the Torah, Chumash Shmos, the third chapter, Parshas Bo, which contains the last three makot. And one of the things that we have realized by now is that there's always warnings. There's always warnings. Moshe Rabbeinu comes and he warns and he threatens and he wags his finger. And the Pharaoh usually scoffs and he laughs and Moshe Rabbeinu warns again. In fact, Rashi tells us in Pshuto Shel Mikra that every makkah was a month-long ordeal. There was 3 weeks of warning and 1 week of plague. So you take a look in chapter 10. You take a look at verse 20, which is the tail end of the plague, which we call locust, arba. And verse 19 tells us that all the locusts suddenly blew out to sea. And we understand that it says all the locusts, it means even the pickled locusts, they didn't even have any last licks, couldn't have any benefit from it anyway. And then, Vayichazek a slave Paroi, Hashem strengthens the heart of the Pharaoh, because already since the hail was falling, he's been saying, Chatosi, Chatosi, I'm a sinner, God is a tzaddik. This time also he says, in verse 16, he says, Chatosi la Hashem, I sinned against God, sinned against you. Sona chatasi, please forgive me, understand. It's like, you know, everybody makes mistakes. And then Hashem strengthens his heart. V'leishilach es b'nei Yisrael. He doesn't send the Jewish people out. So what's supposed to happen now? At the end of a plague? Plague ends. What's supposed to happen now? Now the warnings begin. Pharaoh, if you're not going to let the Jewish people go, a plague is going to be coming. A plague? Oh yeah, a plague. It's going to look like this. And for 3 weeks, there were warnings. And this was on the nightly news, probably, of, you know, whatever, the local stations in Egypt. Everybody was listening and talking about the local plague, and everybody was discussing it, and they all posted on Facebook, the next plague is coming, the next plague is coming. And everybody talked about it for 3 weeks. Maybe it wasn't Facebook, so it took actually 3 weeks to get the word out to everybody. Everybody knew about the plague. And then, boom, the plague hit. Verse 20 tells us that Hashem strengthens the Pharaoh's heart. He doesn't send the Jewish people free. And what happens next? Verse 21, God says to Moses, raise your hand heavenward. We're going to have darkness now. Darkness will envelop the land of Egypt. So the obvious question here is, hey, how come there was no warning? Why is this plague different than all other? Or shall we say, why is this night different than all other nights? So firstly, who says it's even a new plague? If a plague needs a warning and there's a lead up and then the plague comes, who says it's a new plague? So this question was clearly once upon a time discussed. And the Rishonim actually talk about it. And the Balei HaTosfos note that Parsha Zu Petucha. Shehi maka acheret. This parsha is open, which means that it is a new parsha or a new beginning. A word of explanation. We talked about this before, but it's the quick word of explanation. The chapters of the Bible, like we say chapter and verse, are not actually from Moshe Rabbeinu. They're not even from the times of the Mishnah. They're not even Jewish. This is when Gutenberg came along and invented the press. At some point, they started printing the Bible. So they printed the King James Bible or whatever language it was first printed in German or in French. And they said, okay, we printed the King James Bible. We printed the English Bible or whatever the language, Latin Bible. We should print the Hebrew Bible. And they simply followed the same chapters and verses. The monks divided up chapter and verse. And that's why sometimes you have a chapter which begins like three psukim, three verses into a new parsha. It doesn't make any sense. Because they don't understand the Torah. They didn't have Rashi to help them. They didn't have the Rishonim to guide them. They were just reading the words literally. And as such, they misunderstood huge swaths of the Chumash. So they divided it up to the best of their knowledge, which was not so good. How is the Torah divided up? The Torah is divided up what we call parshiot. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking this is the Parsha curiosity class. So a Parsha is the Torah portion we studied that week. But that's actually not correct. That's a borrowed term. The weekly Torah portion in Hebrew is called a Sedra. It's called an order. Like a Seder, Seder night, it's called an order. That's what it really is. And there are Gan Sedarim La Torah. There are 53 orders to the Torah. An order means there's a beginning and end, there's a structure to it. What is a Parsha? A Parsha is the way the actual Torah scroll is written, there are different paragraphs. And each paragraph is called a Parsha. And there are different ways that we identify a Parsha. There's a Parsha Petucha and a Parsha Stuma. And the difference between Stuma and Petucha is how much space we leave before we start the next portion or the next paragraph. We generally don't skip lines unless it's written in a certain way. And when you see when they raise the Torah up, you'll see sometimes larger white areas or smaller white areas. It's checkered. And the reason it's checkered is because we have Parshiot Stumot and Parshiot Petuchot. Every Sedra begins with some space before it. That's a given, with one exception. And that's the last Parsha, euphemism, not literal, last Sedra of the book of Genesis, which is Vayechi. It doesn't have any space in before. It doesn't begin. And interestingly, a few weeks ago we had somebody read the Torah, Parshas Vayechi, but he's not the usual Torah reader, and he's not familiar, and he couldn't find Parshas Vayechi. I had to go to Bima to help him. Because he didn't know that the Parsha doesn't start with a space, or he has forgotten. It's not easy to find. It's just like run-on words that just continue. You have to, here's Parshas Vayechi. So as a rule, how do we know when a new inyan, when a new concept is being introduced? That would be, the demarcation would be with a Parsha. And you'll notice sometimes in your printed Chumash, you'll see a Samach or a Pei. If you ever see a Samach and Pei, wonder what the Samach and Pei is doing there, that means in a Torah scroll, it's written either Stuma or Petucha, which means with more space or less space. So this is a Parsha Petucha, actually. It's not a new chapter. And maybe the monks didn't even understand it. Maybe they didn't even know there was supposed to be 10 plagues. Maybe they don't know. To them, it seemed like a run-on story. And it's understandable why they may have thought that. Because there's no warning in between. It seems like one continuous chapter. But in fact, at the end of verse 20, there's a space. There's no punctuation in the Torah, no periods, but there's a space. And then we start the next parsha, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe. So the Baalei HaTosva said, from the very fact that this parsha is Petucha, we can extrapolate, understand, and derive that this is a separate makkah. It's a separate event. Which leads us then asking the question, if it's a separate event, how come there was no warning here? And the Rishonim talk about this. And there are a number of different answers. Generally speaking, the answers could be divided into two categories. We have the answer of the Ibn Ezra, who says that since Moshe Rabbeinu was chased out of the Pharaoh's palace with such fury and such indignity, he said, I'm not going back. And in fact, our sages tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu did warn the Egyptians for 3 weeks. And in case you're wondering, Tu B'Shvat was the day he started worrying about Choshech. From the 15th day of Shvat until the 8th day of Adar. On the 8th day of Adar, the darkness struck. These dates will come into play later on. You see some very interesting things about these dates a little bit later. But what we do know is that there was a warning, but the Pharaoh didn't get the warning. Or if he got it, he didn't get it from Moshe Rabbeinu as he received the other warnings. So that's what the Ibn Ezra says. The other Mefarshim, primarily the Baalei HaTosfos, had a much more difficult time accepting that Moshe Rabbeinu would do something on his own. He was angry, he was chased out, so he didn't go and warn the Pharaoh. It's true, he wasn't instructed to go warn the Pharaoh, but nonetheless, why wouldn't he tell him? I mean, this follows a system, it follows an order. Every other time he told him, why wouldn't he tell him this time? So the Tosfos, it says, if he would tell them that darkness is coming, what might they do? They might hide their valuables. Because they knew deep down that the Jewish people are going to leave. It's a matter of time. And they also knew that they hadn't paid them for their work in 210 years. Or at least in over a century. So they didn't even get minimum wage. There was no salary. They didn't even feed them normally. In fact, it's really interesting that we say, when we look at the matzah on Pesach, we said, this is the bread that our forefathers ate in Mitzrayim. And the famous question is, what do you mean? They didn't eat this in Mitzrayim. The matzah is what happened the next morning. Why do we say, the achala avasana be'arad de Mitzrayim? Something seems a little out of sorts here. So one of the Mefarshim on the Haggadah actually asked this question. And he says that there is, he brings down from another Sefer, whose name eludes me right now, who quotes the Ibn Ezra as saying, quote, when I was imprisoned in India, they only fed us matzah, never chametz, because a small amount of food could last for longer. They could get the least amount of food, give us the least amount of food, and get the most amount of life out of it. And he says, and from this I understood that when the Jewish people were slaves in Egypt, that they were fed the matzah also. And this actually is the source of the whole idea that we say, that they ate at the Mitzrayim, that is the source. Now, people question whether the Ibn Ezra was actually in India, or if he was imprisoned in India, because we do have stories of the Ibn Ezra's life, and he's led a very colorful life, and he did go to different places, but nowhere does it ever speak of him spending an extended period of time incarcerated in India. So some maintain that he heard this from somebody who was incarcerated in India, who actually afterward came back to Spain and told him about it. At any rate, the Egyptians did not treat the Jewish people very well. They knew they're going to have to remunerate. They knew that the Jewish people are not going to leave empty-handed. And they had a well-founded fear that, maybe the Jewish people are going to come and ask us for a little bit of payment. So they planned to say, we don't have anything. And if they knew darkness was coming, what would they do with their valuables? They would hide them. Guess what? Some of them did hide the valuables. And guess what else? When it came time to leave, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, okay, now you go and ask for the valuables, guess what many Egyptians said? I'd love to give you. Sorry, we don't have anything. Funny you should say that. You mind checking in that closet over there near the dining room? Because I think, how did you know? Yeah, you're right, there's something there. And by the way, in the other corner, there was also, I forgot about that. Because the Jewish people during the Makkah of Choshech were busy checking out everything that was going on in the homes of the wealthy Egyptians. We're going to go back to that a little bit later on. So therefore, because there's this issue of them hiding their valuables, and Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't want them to hide their valuables, so he doesn't tell the Pharaoh. Of course, the problem with this is, why did he tell everybody else? And there seems to be, there was some kind of warning, maybe not to the Pharaoh, but it seems people knew about it. It seems that this idea was out there. And the Ibn Ezra specifically emphasizes, he didn't tell it to the Pharaoh. Even the Balei HaTosfos say, Ve'im Tamar b'pnei Malei Amar Moshe l'Paroi. So it's a little bit hard to understand this. In the writings of the Meshev's Kenim, which is a different collection of Balei HaTosfos, there's a very interesting nuance. It says that the Pharaoh actually did get warned. What was he warned? He was warned there was going to be darkness, but there was two elements to this plague. Number one, it was dark for the Egyptians. Number two, it was light for the Israelites. He didn't tell them the whole story. He only told them a halba maisa, as we say. Since he only relayed half of what's going to occur, so therefore the Balei HaTosfos said, ulefi shegilu lehem miktzat hadavar, because he only revealed a portion, lo kulo, therefore, lechach, therefore, lo nichtava, that's why it's not written. But yes, he did warn him, and it wasn't written. And the Chizkuni goes along in similar idea. He says that the Egyptians shouldn't have time to hide anything, and therefore we had an incomplete kind of warning. All right. So what we do know is that there wasn't a full warning. And what we also know is that the darkness came in a moment. However, it came in a phased fashion, as we're going to see. And this is very, very unusual, something which we don't find with any of the other makot. It doesn't say, first the wild animals came, and then they really came. First there was some frogs. Oh, then there was a lot of frogs. First there was a little bloody, then it was full blood. The Nile River turned to blood, it turned to blood. It was like the makot was a week, it was a week.
But the water didn't turn gradually?
No. No. The movie version maybe gradually. And the scientific explanation of how the plagues weren't really plagues, but kind of just scientific events that just happened to do exactly when Moshe Rabbeinu raised his staff. It's exactly when they happened to unfold. And they unfolded exactly in this particular order until the Pharaoh finally got crushed. And Moshe Rabbeinu knew exactly what was going to happen because he had studied science and he was thousands of years ahead of his time and knew exactly what was going to happen. And this phenomenon has never, ever happened one after the other, after the other, after the other. It's never been documented anywhere in the world. But one time there was a freak of nature, and one time we could explain with 74 different explanations of how everything kind of similarly happened. Now, if you ask me, that's also like a miracle. So if you're already believing in miracles, why can't you just believe what the Chumash says? Like, why does it make people feel better? Okay, that's such a miracle, you know, like a little miracle. Chumash doesn't say that. But when it comes to the darkness, Vayemer Hashem al Moshe, God says to Moshe, Nete yodcha al hashamayim, which the Targum Onkelos says, areim yodoch al tseis shemaya, which means to the letzad shemayim, to the side, towards the heaven. Raise your arms, your hands towards the heaven. Okay, so he raises his hands towards the heaven. And what happens? Vayihi choshech al eretz Mitzrayim. And all of a sudden, Egypt goes dark. A darkness rolls into the land of Egypt. Vayomesh choshech. Number one, Vayihi Choshech. Number two, Vayomesh Choshech. So there are two things that just happened. One is Vayihi, one is Vayomesh. Obvious question, say, what is Vayihi, what is Vayomesh? Then in verse 22 it says, Vayet Moshe es yodo ala shamoyim. Moshe raised his hand to the heaven. Vayihi Choshech afela. And then there was, not Choshech, but Choshech afela, a really dark darkness. And this was B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, Shloshes Yom. Leiro Ishes Ochiv, nobody could see their companion. Leikomu Ish Mitachta, in fact, nobody could even get up for Shloshes Yom. And then we finish off, Lechol Bnei Yisrael, Haya Or B'Moshpatam, all the Jewish people had light in their dwellings. So what falls to us now to explain is this Makkah, which seems to unfold gradually. Vayihi Choshech, Vayomesh Choshech, and then Moshe Rabbeinu seems to be raising his hands again. He just raised his hands. It says, Hashem, he raised his hands. Hashem says, raise up your hand, it's going to be Choshech. Vayomesh Choshech, but he didn't raise his hands yet. Vayet Moshe Yada, no, he did raise his hands, because it became Choshech. Vayet Moshe Yada, Vayihi Choshech Afela. Shloshes Yomim, and then the Torah tells us, Lero Ish Mitachtav. So, okay, so verse 21 is just describing what's going to happen. All right. And verse 22 is describing what happened. So why does verse 21 say Vayihi? And why does it say Vayomish? And why does verse 22 tell us about Choshech Afela, which we haven't heard about till now? And then we say, Leroish, Vilo Kamu. They didn't see and they didn't get up. Why don't you just say they didn't get up? And of course, last but not least, what does it mean they didn't get up? We're talking about darkness over here. What does getting up and sitting down have to do with anything? So, yeah, it is, but it doesn't say v'yihi yeh. At verse 21, Hashem is talking to Moshe, but it says...
He's describing to him what's going to happen once he raises.
Yes, correct, sorry. Verse 21 is he's describing, verse 22 is what happens. So I ask you a question. Why, when he describes it, he says v'yihi, and then it says v'yomesh? First of all, it says v'yihi yeh. And then we talk about choshech afela. It didn't say anything about Choshech Afela the first time. It just said Choshech two times, but we had different verbs in before. We had a Vayihi and Vayomish. And the second time, we have a new description. A Choshech, which is Afela. So something is missing here. And then we hear about Leroish. And then we say V'leikamu. What does Leikamu have to do with anything? What does that have to do with darkness? Darkness means the inability to see. That's what darkness means. Darkness does not mean the inability to move. But somehow this darkness does, it seemed, create inability to move. So dark you can't move? People who are blind move around. People who see nothing move around. What does mobility have to do with darkness? Maybe it's thick. Okay. Well, obviously there's something going on here. Yes. Well, you're not wrong, but yes.
Well, maybe the whole point of the Makkah is that it's a final warning because before Moshe sent to save Bnei Israel, Paro says, I don't know if it was the last parasha or the parasha before, that he tells Moshe something along the lines of, like, Paro took my firstborn, now I'm going to slay his firstborn. So maybe all of this was a big lead up to that. And now this Makav Choshech is a warning for that. Maybe Vayihi Choshech is kind of the warning, like it's symbolizing the warning, like here the Choshech is coming. Vayimasha Choshech, the Egyptians understand what's going on. It's tangible to them. They understand that this is kind of the beginning of the end, and then the Choshech Hafila, it's like total darkness. They can't do anything about it. Hashem can't, like he can't harden Pharaoh's heart anymore to give him the strength to say no. They're kind of trapped, and like the final monk is coming.
Okay, so let me summarize what you're saying. You tell me if I understood you right. Yes, but no. Well, I think what you're trying to say is that this is part of the warning. But the problem is the other eight makot that preceded this have very clear and explicit verses that say Moshe said to the Pharaoh. Here it doesn't say that. Here the conversation is between God and Moshe. Verse 21 is Hashem Vayomar Hashem El Moshe. So it's a very creative way to case it. Vayihi Choshech, Vayomesh Choshech. It's coming. It's actual. But it doesn't say that. And remember, the Makkah of Choshech is not there in isolation. It falls in a succession of all the Makkah to come before. And there's a certain order of how things unfolded.
But how many times is Pharaoh going to be warned? Meaning, there's different explanations to Hashem.
It would seem every time. In fact, even from Makkah's Bechoros, he gets a warning. Because when he calls him back after Makkah's Choshech, Moshe says, here's what's coming next. The Pharaoh says, I never want to see you again. Moshe says, funny, you should say that. I'm not coming back anymore. And the next time the Pharaoh's running after him. So even Makat Bechorot, which is in the beginning, you're correct, before all the Makat started, Hashem says, I'm going to slay your firstborn. It's like, it's in the beginning, Hashem gave him the climax, right? And Rashi says there, usually, if you have a secret weapon, you don't put your weapons on the table. Never put your cards on the table. You have to have a surprise element. Hashem says, no surprises. Here's where this is going to end up. Here's where it's going to end. I'm not afraid of you, right? Hashem doesn't have to play any games. But each of the makot had a warning. This makot has no warning. Anyway, we have to now understand this business of the terminology here is difficult to understand. So let's take a look in Rashi, and then we're going to try to see what the other mefarshim say. Let's just try to understand this simple on a simple pshat level. How do we understand these verses? Rashi says the issue here, vayihi choshech, is not a problem. It's not a problem. Hashem is saying this is going to happen now. That's going to happen. You're going to raise your hand. And then it says, Vayomesh Choshech. What does Vayomesh mean? So Rashi is going to tell us, Vayomesh means Vayachshich, basically. It darkled, or it got darkened. Vayachshich Aleihem. It became dark. A Choshech Yoser Mecheshko Shalaila. Rashi is telling us that in verse 21, before the darkness comes, the Torah is telling you that this darkness is not what you think darkness is. It's not the darkness you're used to. Invariably, every experience we talk about, we put against our frame of reference. You talk about a hot day, you think about the hottest day you ever experienced. You talk about a cold day, you think about the cold day you ever experienced, etc., etc. We always put our frame of reference. You tell somebody about darkness. You know what darkness is. We've all had experiences of being in the dark. Figuratively, literally, we're in the dark. Okay, and if it's night, and if it's a moonless night, and you happen to be way up somewhere up north where there's no city lights, you're really going to be in the dark. You can actually really be in the dark. So the Torah wants you to know that this is not that kind of dark. Why? Because darkness, as a rule, is simply the absence of light. That's what darkness is. The moment there is light, there's no more darkness. It's instantaneous. That's the nature of the photons. The photons travel at such speed. In fact, there's nothing that travels faster than light. That's what we call it at the speed of light. We talk about light years. Because neutrons and protons that are held together with electrons are tangible physicality. And then there is a non-tangible physicality, which is called photons. And that's why photon is the least tangible part of our physical existence. Light is physical, but it's not so physical. It's not really tangible. It's visible. And sometimes you have a camera and you do it, they play these games, you have to make it, you know, many, many times slower. You can actually see light spilling. You can actually see these things. They have cameras today that can capture the speed of light. Slow down the speed of light, they can actually see how light is traveling. Slow it down like 10,000 times or something like that with technology. But when in our real time, in our world, the way light travels, photons, there is no protons or neutrons that can travel as quickly as photons. That's the nature of light. So we know that darkness, as a rule, is not a positive entity. It's simply a vacuum. It's an emptiness. That's how we know darkness. Why is it dark at night? Because the luminaries that give light to planet Earth are blocked. Planet Earth turns. The sun is here. You're here. No wonder you have no light. If you have a moonlit evening, so then you have light which is reflecting off the moon. You have light. If the moon is concealed, it's Erev Rosh Chodesh, and there's no moon, and you're dead in the dead of the night, and there's no sun, what do you have? You have darkness. And even then, you have the light of the clouds. It would have to be a very cloudy night, and a moonless night, and in the middle of the dead of the night, so you actually to have no light whatsoever. You know what night vision goggles are? I'm sure you've seen some of the videos of Israeli soldiers doing these unbelievable things, and actually have a camera of night vision. Night vision goggle technology is very simple. There's always some light. In the darkest reality, there's always some light. The night vision goggles are made in a way that it magnifies the smallest point of light 10,000 times. So when you're wearing these glasses, you have the ability to see, utilize the smallest particle of light. It magnifies the photons. So therefore, you're actually able to see. It's not like in the middle of the afternoon, but you can see where you're going around. The night vision goggle light is very strange. It's like silhouette. It's like surreal. It's not, you're not seeing things that are illuminated in a normal way, but you're magnifying the light to that position. I went, you know, it used to say that tzaddikim have lichtige egen. It's an expression. Tzaddikim have illuminated eyes. So I said to somebody, it's very simple. A tzaddik is outfitted with night vision goggles. He looks at a yid who's so dark, and the tzaddik looks at him, and he sees that one point of light 10,000 times. So the tzaddik looks at a yid. He sees a neshama. He says, oh, look at this. It's a beautiful yid. Everybody says, what are you talking? What does he see? We don't see it. Of course you don't see it. You don't have night vision goggles. You don't see it. The tzaddik has the ability to see tiny points of light, and that's the tzaddik's narrative. His narrative is narrative of light. So everything is light-filled. Anyway, that's just a parenthetical thing. Darkness, as a rule, is the absence of light. Because darkness is the absence of light, it really doesn't make sense to say, it was very dark in Egypt. What, it was only dark in Egypt? Like, what exactly does that mean? How did it get dark here and not here? Which some say on a literal level means in Goshen there was light. So what does that mean, in Goshen there was light? How did you like selectively had the light flew here, we had the rays over here, and the rays here, and here was dark? It doesn't work like that. The nature of photons is that they travel, they spill, they spread. So how would that work? Was the whole world plunged into darkness? No, it doesn't say that. Pasuk is very clear. The darkness is in the land of Mitzrayim. So most people sitting at the Seder table and they hear Makas, Choshech, a Makkah, a plague of Choshech. Oh yeah, it was night. It was night for a week. Really? That doesn't make any sense. You can't have night here and not somewhere else. Say, oh yes, it was a solar eclipse. Moses predicted a week-long solar eclipse. It never happened before, never happened after, but it was a week-long solar eclipse. There wouldn't be an Eretz Mitzrayim. That would be everywhere. And what would the choshech of the night look like then? Would they know it's Makas Choshech? Like, how would that work? So therefore, Rashi says that Vayomesh Choshech is trying to tell you about a different kind of choshech. This was not regular choshech. This is not absence of light. This is Choshech yoter micheshkol shalayla. It's a much deeper darkness. In other words, choshech shalayla ya'amish v'yachshich od. The darkness that you know of, the darkness somehow becomes more tangible. It thickens. It becomes more real. In other words, it becomes a new reality. It's not the absence of something. It becomes positively dark. And Rashi goes into the whole next Rashi, is a whole grammar Rashi of explaining the word Vayomesh. What does the word Vayomesh come from? And Rashi basically says the word Vayomesh comes from the word like Emesh Laila. It comes from darkness of night. It actually comes from darkness. It means to darkle. That's what it means. But how do you darkle darkness? You can only darkle where there isn't darkness. So you can only darkle darkness if there's a different kind of darkness we're talking about. And therefore, that's what Rashi says. The vayomish means there's a different kind. Why doesn't it have an aleph? It's a word is emesh. Rashi spends a whole bunch of ink over here explaining why the aleph is dropped. And that's actually the style of biblical grammar, that sometimes an aleph will be dropped. It brings you no less than three examples of where an aleph in a word is left aside. But the word, if you look at the root word, you would understand it as with the aleph. Okay. So, now that we know that the darkness is a little bit of a thicker darkness, or a darkness that's not ordinary darkness, and Rashi goes on to say, he finishes that the Medrash Agada is, that the Vayomesh also shares a root, or at least is a pun intended, so to speak. It also alludes to the concept of mamash, which means tangible, that there was a tangible darkness. It was kafalu mechupal, was av ad shahoya by mamash. Now this is very hard to understand. What does this mean? What is he talking about here when he says that there was such a darkness? And it's very interesting to point out that Rabbeinu Bechaya says that you have to understand that this darkness came at a time when day was breaking, when it was starting to get light. So they realized that the darkness came. It was a darkness, he says, Kadeshi Yisparsim Eitzel HaKoil, in order that everybody should know what's going on. This is not an ordinary phenomenon or a night that's never ending. Lochola Hamaka Achayusar Choshech HaLaila. The Rabbeinu Bechaya says, this didn't come until night actually ended. So it seems that at dawn of the morning of the eighth day of Adar, when the night started to lift, or the sun started to illuminate the planet, at least in that part of the world, then Oz Ba'achoshech. That's when the darkness came. The words of Rabbeinu Bechaya are really, in a sense, very much similar to what Targum Onkelos is saying. The Ben Bechaya alludes to that. Now the Sefarno adds a wonderful nuance here. He says, you need to understand that Hashem removed Choshech HaTivi, which means the darkness we know of, natural darkness. Because he says, Omnam Choshech Laila, and listen to the words that the Sefarno uses. It's so, he says, Choshech Laila hu avir muchan lekabel or. It's atmospheric, that is ready to receive light. It's the atmosphere of darkness does not preclude photonic activity. It allows for photonic activity. That's the nature of the atmosphere of darkness. Hu choshech beheder ha'or bevad. It's only the lack of light. It's just vacancy. But he says this choshech is very different. This is avir bilti muchan lekabelor. This is the kind of atmosphere that cannot receive light. Black. Yes, I was waiting for somebody to say that. We're reading a Sefarno that was authored over 750 years ago, and he's describing almost exactly the language we use for dark matter or for a black hole. Which, by the way, the scientific community is divided over whether a dark hole and black matter, is the same thing. They may not be the same thing. And I want to tell you furthermore that according to all the research I did today, there is absolutely nobody alive who has ever actually experienced being in a black hole. There's nobody who's experienced being in dark matter. We'll talk about blindness in a second. One second, we'll go to that in a second. But that's not going to fit here.
Light around them, they still couldn't benefit.
Hold that thought. We'll go back to blindness in a minute. But the way we know about negative matter is only by means of extrapolation. So basically, science has come to an awareness, or what seems to be pretty clear, that we need electrons to hold together neutrons and protons, and that everything in the world has an alter ego. So they have the alter ego of electrons are called positrons. And positrons have a different kind of density if you can use that word, and the nature of positrons, or the way that the nuclear, the quantum physics of dark matter or a black hole is such that it would not allow for photonic activity to express itself. It would swallow the photonic reality. Now, the Sephardim's writing this 750 years ago. This is crazy. This is unbelievable that he understood this. He says, this is what we call, it's something which is not mukhan lechabalor. He uses like beautiful rabbinic Hebrew. It's not susceptible to light. It's like God changed the quantum physics of the atmosphere over Egypt. Now, how did they live? Like, because what happens is when, and this is only theoretical because it's never been observed, but when electrons come in contact with positrons, they destroy each other, which this is called, and you'll forgive the term, annihilation. That's a scientific term. Positrons and electrons meet, results in annihilation. Right, matter and antimatter necessarily doesn't allow for the quantum physics structure to continue to exist, which would mean that you cannot simply say, yeah, it was a black hole, or it was dark matter. That, first of all, nobody's ever experienced it, like I said. And we base it on observation of things like a universe that's supposed to be slowing down, but instead is getting faster, or is supposed to be shrinking, and instead is expanding, or there's different phenomena that they're actually able to clock and observe. And the things that they're able to clock and observe tell them that there has to, at some point, be a shift in quantum physics. Quantum physics has to be different somewhere, somehow, but we never saw it. All of this is theoretical science. None of this is fact. But what is, if you will, fact is that we can talk about the concept of an atmosphere that somehow doesn't allow for photonic activity, which we can't imagine what that would mean. I don't think we would be able to exist in dark matter. Dark matter negates what we call positive matter. Positive matter needs a certain atmosphere or a certain quantum structure to be able to exist. But this is what the Sephardim is describing. And he says that's why they couldn't see each other. And that's why, he says, if it was dark, so go light a candle. That's a simple question. They had a long night. Light candles. No, they couldn't find the candles. Give me a break. Blind people get around. When there's a blackout, people get around. How come nobody got around here? And then, that's in verse 21. But then we come all of a sudden to verse 22, and we don't talk about Vayomesh Choshech. We talk about Choshech Afela. Ah, Choshech Afela. So Rashi says, actually, this is a different kind of Choshech. It's a different kind of Choshech. This Choshech is, he says, what happened is like this. First, L'ro Ish Es Echev Kol Esh Shloshe Yamim. First, for 3 days, they couldn't see anything. But not only they couldn't see anything, they couldn't see anything to the point that they couldn't bring themselves to the possibility of seeing anything. Like the Sephardim says, the atmosphere does not allow photonic activity. So everybody's in the dark, literally. And then, says Rashi, another 3 days. And this other 3 days is a choshech mechupol. It's much, much denser. Maybe this is the difference between dark antimatter or black hole, which is two terms that the scientific community is divided over whether it's the same thing or something else. And he says the second or more intense darkness is shalekamu ish mitachtav. They couldn't move. They couldn't move. Yoshev and Yochalamed, the person who was sitting, was under such pressure from this atmosphere they were living in that he couldn't get up. Omed, the person who was standing, and Yochaleshev, he couldn't sit. So that's the meaning of that things were so dark that they weren't able even to move. At a certain point, the intensity of this dark matter immobilized them. So we're talking about levels of antimatter, which nobody knows what we're talking about, because as I said, I don't think anybody's ever observed or ever been to a black hole yet. Excellent question. You know, the Ralbag, Gersonides, he says something fascinating. He says the Egyptians were holding their noses and closing their mouth because if they would breathe in this air, it would annihilate them. But then the question they ask is, so what did they live for a week without breathing? How exactly did this work? Here's what I'm pretty certain of. I'm pretty certain that we are not certain of exactly how this went. Exactly what this means, we don't know. But here's what is clear. It was not darkness in the manner that you speak of when you refer to darkness. This was not the darkness of night. This was a positive entity. This was a transformed quantum physics that came upon the land of Mitzrayim. Now Rashi does something very unusual here. Very unusual. In fact, he hasn't done this for the last eight plagues. He asks a question. Okay, that's not so unusual. But the question he asks is unusual. He says, "V'lo mehevi aleihem cheshech." Why did he bring darkness? Why did he bring darkness? Did Rashi ask why did he bring frogs? Did Rashi ask why did he bring wild animals? Did Rashi ask why did he bring locusts? Or why did he bring hail that had to have fire inside the ice? Rashi didn't ask any of these questions. There's lots written about, and there's much in Torah literature, but Rashi doesn't talk about it. Why all of a sudden, what compelled Rashi to suddenly ask a question? And Rashi says, I'll tell you why. Shehoyu b'Yisrael b'Yisadar Rishoyim, there were very wicked people living in this time. They didn't want to leave Mitzrayim. Now you picture this. Some Jews leave Egypt, some Jews stay in Egypt. Could you imagine? Forever we'll be fighting. Who's the real Jew? This is like a disaster. I'm the Jew, you're the Jew. No, you left Egypt. Jews are really Egyptian. No, Jews are really Israeli. It would be a disaster. It's bad enough as it is. Hashem says, no good. You don't want to leave? You don't want to leave. All these people died in Shleishas Me'afela, 3 days of darkness. Why? Why? Because they had to die, because they wouldn't leave. What does that have to do with darkness? Rashi says, Kedei sheleyiru mitzriyim b'mapalosam. The Egyptians shouldn't see, the Jews are suffering too. We suffer, they suffer. So it's not their God. he's equal opportunity here. He beats everybody up. V'yoyim raf heim leikun kameinu. Then Rashi says, the oid. And then there was something else. Chipsu Yisrael. The Jewish people went for a little bit of hide-and-go-seek, a little search mission. And they went through all the things that the wealthy neighbors had. And then the next time, in the end, when they had to leave Mitzrayim, v'yishoylim, and they came to borrow, quote-unquote, after not getting paid for a century. Sorry, we'd love to give you. And we didn't klum. We don't have anything. He says, the Israelite says, funny you say that. Anira Isiv, I seem to remember seeing something Bevesecha. Ubimak complaining you, I'll tell you exactly where it is. And at that point, well, what are you gonna do? He says, right, that thing. Yeah, of course I'm happy to give it to you. Oh, that thing. So first of all, what compels Rashi to ask this question altogether? What forces Rashi to say this? So there are two general explanations that are given. One explanation, the Bartanura says, if you look in the Pasuk, it says, Leiro ish esechav, v'leikamu ish mitachta. What's the v'loi? Sounds like two different things here. Either leiro or leikamu. You want to describe the darkness as so thick you can't move, you don't have to say that you can't see. Anyway, darkness means you can't see. Even if it wasn't such thick darkness, you wouldn't be able to see. You can't see in any darkness. So if the darkness would be so thick that you can't move, why do you have to say you can't see? So clearly there was two levels of darkness. And in general, the fact is that the Torah speaks about Shleishas Yomim and Shleishas Yomim, 3 days and 3 days. So since the 3 days and 3 days, we have to find some kind of reason for this. Furthermore, the Levush Ha'ira, which is the Baal HaLevush, the Mizrahi, they say even a simpler thing. What was the purpose of a Makkah? It was to break Egypt. And one of the things that had to happen is that the Egyptians were being smitten and that the Jewish people, the Israelites, were not being smitten. And this Rashi itself proves it, because if all of a sudden the wicked Israelites will start dying, what will the Egyptians say? That's not a plague directed against us. That's not anything we did wrong. Look, they're suffering too. Comes the question, if they're in the dark, how did they know the Jews had light? When they're drinking blood and they have to pay for money, pay for water, we know that they have blood and the Israelites have water. When they have frogs in the bed and frogs in the head and the Jewish people are having just life is fine, life is great, they're not bothering them, they see a difference. When they're all scratching themselves and they got lice and the Israelites don't have lice, they see a difference. When wild animals come tearing through the streets of every single neighborhood, of every single municipality, all over Egypt, except for the areas where the Jews are, they see it. And so it is also with the burrad, and so it is with the grasshoppers. They could see a difference. they were struck, the Israelites were spared. But if they had darkness, how did they know the Israelites had light? This makkah is a counterintuitive makkah. It actually makes no sense. It said, I'm going to give you a makkah, and I'm going to teach you. Because the makkah was not just about hitting them, it was about teaching them. This was a rehabilitative experience. They were supposed to get re-educated until that they should come to recognize that there is a God in the world, that they are not the master of their own destiny, that if they behave in an evil way, they will receive just remuneration. But this makkah doesn't seem to serve any purpose because they were in the dark, literally. So if you kept them in the dark, what kind of makkah was it? And therefore, the Levush Ha'ira says, Rashi is compelled to give us a different kind of reason here. You should know, and for all the makkas, there are reasons. There's lots of stuff in Chazal, different reasons why for all the makkas. And the makkah of Choshech is no different. For example, you've got like a whole bunch of different things it says about why Choshech. There's a medrash that says that the Egyptians sought to assimilate and to mix the Jewish people into the darkness of Egypt, and there should be no distinction. We should destroy the Jewish people. There should be no Israelite people left. Hashem says, oh, you wanted to destroy my people. You wanted to put them in the dark? I'll put you in the dark. Okay, fine. And that's why we say, like, hamavdil, make havdalah. What do we use? The havdalah candle. We use fire. We use light. It's the opposite of havdalah. They sought to divide, take away the divisions. The Medrash Tanchuma says, you put them in prison, you kept them in the dark, now you're in the dark. There's a Medrash HaGadol that says that the Mitzri, an Egyptian, would want to eat. He would put a lantern on a Jew's head. And he said, okay, you'll be the lamp today. And he said, you move, that lamp falls, I behead you. And the poor Jew would be shaking in his boots with a lantern, bouncing a lantern on his head, afraid to lose his head off his shoulders. Hashem said, oh, you tormented my children? I'll keep you in the dark. There's even a Medrash HaGadol that says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always strikes with darkness. He says he struck the Pharaoh with darkness. He struck Sancheriv with darkness. He struck Belshazzar with darkness. He struck Haman with darkness. I don't want to go into the Medrash. The Medrash has descriptive things for each one, how each one got stuck. And when Mashiach is going to come, it says, HaChoshech Yichasa Ares V'Arofa Le'umim, there's going to be darkness before Mashiach comes too. There's going to be some kind of plague of darkness for our enemies. What that means, I hope we find out soon. I don't know. So what, why is there like a reason? Why do you have darkness? But the answer is, these are all midrashic things, but in Pshuto Shel Mikra, in a literal meaning, we need to have a reason for the darkness. And the darkness, which is not normative darkness as we know it, not the absence of light, all of a sudden undergoes a metamorphosis. First it's really dark, tangibly really dark, but then it gets so dark they can't move. Well, why did that happen? What was the purpose of having it really dark and then even darker? Why have 3 days one way and then go even further? By the way, the famous question is asked. There's even the Radvaz was even asked this question. What happened to the week long? It says every makkah was a week long. So there's actually a very interesting Bereshis Rabba about this. He says, yeah, Choshech was also a week long. It was? He says, yeah. It was 3 days. Then another 3 days. And then when they came to Kriyas Yamsuf, it says the Israelites had light and the Egyptians were in the dark. That was the seventh day. Every makkah was 7 days. Seven represents a full experience. You have a chasen and kala, get married, mazel tov, they celebrate for 7 days. God forbid somebody loses a loved one, you have to sit shiva, you have to mourn in 7 days. A week is the totality of the human experience. The full shade, the full range of human experience has to have a week. And only then are its lessons imparted. Only then is the experience fully developed. So this idea of a week is necessary, it seems. So the Medrash Rabba says, don't worry, they got the week. But here we have first 3 days, and then another 3 days. So therefore, Rashi's thesis here is that the 3 days of darkness and then the second 3 days of darkness had to serve two different purposes. The first was that under the cover of darkness, the wicked Jews had to be taken care of. Hashem is going to cause them to die. Somebody's got to bury them. Somebody cover the evidence. Because otherwise, Egyptians come out of this darkness and they go, oh, look at all these dead Jews. So the poor Yidden were never burying the not such good Israelites or really wicked Israelites. And then, what was the next thing the Israelites had to do? What was the next mission? Take stuff. Now, I ask you, you walk into somebody's house. You're in the guy's in the dark. You don't know somebody's in your house? Huh? So then, if the first darkness wasn't good enough, the first darkness, they could still move about, but they couldn't see anything. The first, we needed the cover of darkness, a full cover of darkness, the kind of darkness that they shouldn't be able to turn on the lamp. Should be able to turn on a fire, so it's already a negative matter. It's the kind of darkness that doesn't allow photonic activity. The second darkness, being devoid of photonic activity, is not enough. I need to be frozen in their place. He says, that's when it got even darker. In other words, this is Rashi telling us, that the makkah of darkness served two purposes. And whose purposes was it for? It's really all about us.
How would they see in the dark? How would the Israelites see in the dark?
How would the Israelites see in the dark? This is the other part of the miracle. That's the other side of the miracle. And here it gets really interesting, and I told you to hold this thought, because the Rabbeinu Ephraim says that they were dying till the 13th day of Adar, because the darkness starts on the 8th. He says they're dying till the 13th. He says, guess who wanted to kill us on the 13th day of Adar? Haman. And what do we do on the 13th day of Adar, till this very day? He says, we have Tanit Esther. We fast to remember what was supposed to happen then. That's why we fast. It's a fast day, Erev Purim. And this gets even really interesting. Rabbeinu Ephraim says that Or is Bigematria Be'adar. Do the calculation. Be'adar. Be'adar means in Adar. Beis, Aleph, Dalet, Resh. Dalet and Beis, 4 and 2 is 6. In the Hebrew, 6 is Vav. Aleph, Vav, Resh is Or. So Or is Be'adar. And what does it say happened Be'adar? It says, La'yehudim haita Ora. V'simcha v'sasim v'yikor. What does it say over here? It says here in verse 23, U'lechol b'nei Yisrael haya Or b'moshvotam. Exactly at the time when everybody else, the Egyptians were in the dark, our enemies in the dark, and we had light, thousands of years later, at the same time, the same thing happened. We had light. Laihudim haita or. In other words, there's a link here between these days which lead up to Purim and the concept of light. So this is clearly a miracle. This couldn't be a typical or normative thing. Obviously, there was a miracle going on over here. So there's two questions which I think have to be dealt with. And then after we go to those two questions, I'm going to share with you some very, really interesting stuff. The first question is, we know that there were many Jewish people. We know there's many Jewish people who were sinners. We know there's many, unfortunately. And we know about some of those sinners who left Mitzrayim. How do we know? Because there was, forget even before Dor HaMidbar, there's a guy named Micha. There's two Michas. Don't confuse them with the later Micha. I once had a whole email exchange. Somebody told me, you got Micha mixed up. I said, I got Micha mixed up. There's two Michas. There's a Micha that Moshe Rabbeinu saved, okay? He was squeezed into a wall. A baby dying, squeezed into a wall because the cruel, inhuman taskmasters, the Nazis, they took, we said, you don't have bricks, we use your babies. And Moshe Rabbeinu begs Hashem, I need to save this baby. And Hashem says, keep going. And Moshe says no. And Moshe Rabbeinu takes this Micha out of the wall. He saves him. Against the explicit instruction from Hashem. This Micha grows up later on to be a little idolater. He's a big troublemaker, this Micha. By the way, this Micha follows Moshe Rabbeinu around. And when Moshe Rabbeinu remembers in the last moment that they have to leave Mitzrayim with Yosef. How did they get Yosef? They made an upside down pyramid. And they sank his coffin to the bottom of this man-made lake. How do you get Yosef? So Moshe Rabbeinu wrote on a piece of paper, Alei Shor. Yosef is metaphorized as Shor. And a moment later, it bobbed to the top. Moshe Rabbeinu took Yosef's cloth and it went off. Who took the paper? Micha. What did this Micha troublemaker do? When the Jewish people made that terrible disaster, a golden calf, when they threw in the gold, Micha threw in the paper of Moshe. What did it say? Alei Shor. No, look what happened. This is the troublemaker. The greatest disaster of all time came about through Micha. So Micha is going through Kriyas Yamsuf, and he's holding an idol, and he's singing praises to his idol. Middle of Kriyas Yamsuf. In middle of Kriyas Yamsuf was not just the sea split open. It's a metaphoric of revelation that was only second to Matan Torah itself. And Micha's worshipping an idol. So Micha got to go out of Egypt. He didn't die in the 3 days. And they did die in the 3 days? What's the pshat? Like what did they do that was so bad? How terrible were their sins? In general, we know, halalu evdi avedah zarah, v'halalu evdi avedah zarah. The famous medrash, the malachim was saying, these are idolaters. Like, what difference? What did they do that didn't allow them to go out of Mitzrayim? You know what the answer is? Rashi said. He said, Loi hayu roitzim latzis. They wouldn't leave. And the Rebbe uses a beautiful metaphor from Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a day of atonement. It's not a day of Yom Tshuva. We're supposed to do Tshuva, but that's not what Yom Kippur is. You could do Tshuva any day. What is Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is actually not about us. It's about God. It's the day that God cleanses us. It's the day God overlooks. A kippur means atonement. He forgives us. We are atoned. We are cleansed. And there's even an opinion in the Gemara, which is of Rabbi Yehuda, that if a Jew doesn't do tshuva, it still works. By the way, don't get too excited. It's not the halacha. You have to do tshuva. But the tshuva you do only makes you susceptible to receive this atonement. It doesn't actualize the atonement. Because you could do tshuva any day of the year. Oh no, you're supposed to do tshuva today. You can do tshuva anytime. It's not true. The moment you do an aveira, you have an obligation to do tshuva. But the tshuva simply makes you able to download the energy of Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur, according to Rabbi Yehuda, forgives everybody, even if you don't do tshuva. With the exception of one kind of Jew. Only one kind of Jew cannot be atoned by Yom Kippur. What sin could that be? Koresh the Yoima, violating Yom Kippur. You can't suck and blow at the same time. If you violate Yom Kippur, how do you expect Yom Kippur to work? It's an oxymoron. If you recognize Yom Kippur, if you acknowledge Yom Kippur, okay. But if you're laughing at Yom Kippur is not going to work. So every Jew, every sinner can leave Mitzrayim, except one kind of Jew. The Jew refuses to leave. I refuse to leave. I'm taking you out. I'm not going. It's a real problem. It's a real problem. So those Jews, Hashem has no choice. He begged them. He sent them Moshe Rabbeinu. They had Aaron. They had Miriam. They didn't listen. There was no choice. So this concept, this is the Jews who had to die during those 3 days. The evidence gets covered. And now the Jews go on to the next mission, which is to go and search. And here's something really interesting. It says in the Medrash that the Jewish people were outfitted with Superman glasses. They had X-ray vision. There was a light, a supernal light. Not only could they could see through the walls and the vaults. Where people hid things, they could see where it was hidden too. Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi just says they had light. They weren't in the dark. And because they weren't in the dark, they were able to search. In fact, Rashi uses the words, he says, chipsu. Chipsu, what does chipsu mean? What does lechapes mean? To search. If you have X-ray glasses, you have Superman glasses, you don't have to search. You see it. If you have to search, means you don't see it easily. So why would Rashi have a different approach than the Medrash? The Medrash has that approach. What compelled Rashi not to tell us in Pshuto Shel Mikra? We're talking miracles anyway. We're like, it's not like you have to minimize the miracle and then make it more believable. Rebbe says, we have a principle. The principle is that mitzvahs have to be done in natural manner. In a material sense, within the framework, the gestalt of nature that Hashem created. And a miraculous mitzvah is not a mitzvah. So, for example, one of the questions that's asked about the menorah that burned for 8 days, but if it was a miraculous oil, it's not a mitzvah. That's discussed. There's a different answer for it. There's an answer for that. The Rebbe has an answer how exactly that worked. But this is a concept. I'll tell you a little story. So the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Chabad movement, as you know, was incarcerated in the Peter Paul fortress. He spent 53 days there, accused of high treason. It could have been a death sentence. That's what was being talked about. And the reason is because it was unfortunately slandered by fellow Jews, by observant fellow Jews, who wanted to squash and suffocate the Hasidic movement because they were convinced that it would destroy Judaism. They had all kinds of ideas in their head that it was a great danger to Judaism, and therefore it was a big mitzvah to have the Alter Rebbe rubbed out, and then Hasidus could simply suffocate, and then they can go back to living normal lives. Of course, history has proven this to be very nefarious. At any rate, and the actual charges were that he's sending money to Turkey, because the Alter Rebbe founded a charity, which is the oldest continuously active charity doing this work, of sending money to poor people living in Eretz Yisrael. It's called Kol Chabad. The Alter Rebbe was responsible for raising those funds. At that time, Palestine, which was not a dirty word then, that's what the Jews lived in Palestine, it was under the Turkish Empire, Turkish rule. Because there's no such thing as a Palestinian government. There never was such a thing. The whole thing is a myth. It's not true. It was just a piece of land called this name or that name or the other name. And by the way, Jordan was also Palestine. And that whole piece of land was administered by the Ottoman Empire. Okay. So the Alter Rebbe is in prison. And you know, Yutes Kislev is the day he gets out. Okay. So Rosh Chodesh Kislev is in prison. And then a week after Rosh Chodesh, what does a Jew do? One of the things we do is we look at the new moon and we make a special bracha, because Kiddush Levana. You're not allowed to say Kiddush Levana in a house. You have to be outside. You have to be under the heavens. So now, the Alter Rebbe in the Peter Paul fortress has like a moat around it. And he was being taken out to what's today, I think, called the Winter Palace. The Hermitage is over there, and the Winter Palace is like a long rectangle building that faces the Peter Paul fortress. It's still standing. You can see all this today. It's kind of like, you know, the Billy Bishop Airport, the city airport? You get on with your car and it takes you across. It takes like 2 minutes. It's the same kind of thing. It's like a little island right next to the city. And it's built on this island. So the Alter Rebbe is in this little boat. I don't know. I was on the boat. I was there. It took maybe, the whole story has to take not 5 minutes. And the Alter Rebbe says, please stop the boat because I want to make a bracha on the moon. And you're not supposed to make a bracha on the Levana when the boat is moving. So the guy's like, stop the boat. Who do you think you are? The jailer, jailbird, stop the boat. The Alter Rebbe said, please stop the boat. He said, no. So the boat stopped. And the guy can't get it to go. He's rowing, he's pushing. The boat's like frozen. He said, okay, this is a little funny. And the Alter Rebbe says, are you going to stop the boat for me? So the guy says, what are you going to give me? I give you a blessing. I think the story goes that he got from the Alter Rebbe actually a handwritten note, and his subsequent generations treasured his handwritten note to put it in a gold frame. But anyway, the boat starts moving again. He stops the boat, and the Alter Rebbe does Kiddush Levana, and then from there he goes into his next interrogation. So the Rebbe asks a simple question. Why did he have to stop the boat? Why did he need the oarsmen to stop the boat? If the Alter Rebbe could stop a boat by itself, so stop the boat. What do you ask him to stop the boat? And then he asks him, and he says, no. He makes the boat stop miraculously. Think he's going to stop the boat for me? It moves again. The fellow stops the boat, and then the Alter Rebbe is Mekadosh Levana. Does it make sense? You want to be Mekadosh Levana, stop the boat, say your blessing, and move on. So the Rebbe says, because a mitzvah has to be done by means of nature. Now, it's true that he used a little other powers to get the guy to stop the boat, but in fact, when the boat was stopped, it was done by means of nature. The mitzvahs have to be done. The Jewish people had a mitzvah. Hashem said, please, actually. He didn't say please with most of the mitzvahs. He says, thou shalt, or shalt not. He doesn't say please. He doesn't say, please keep Shabbat. He doesn't say, please put on tefillin. He says, do it. This mitzvah, he says, no, please. Why? You have a whole Rashi about this, that the patriarchs and the matriarchs will come and say, hey, this is my children. You tormented them, and then they didn't leave with wealth. Please, he says, please go and borrow. And there's a whole discussion, why borrow? What's up with the borrow? A longer barbinel about that. I'm not going to go into that. But the point is that it was like a mitzvah. What's a mitzvah? A mitzvah is an instruction. Hashem says, do this for me. Hashem says to the Jewish people, do this for me. Well, if it's a mitzvah, it has to be done in natural means. So therefore, Rashi rejects the idea of the Medrash that they had super x-ray glasses and everything was miraculous. They weren't doing a mitzvah. Yeah, they're doing a mitzvah. They're doing what they were commanded to do. Since they're doing what they're commanded to do, it's got to follow the laws of nature. Okay, fine. So therefore, Rashi makes this miracle as natural as possible. By the way, what is the Medrash saying? Could be the Medrash held that this doesn't have to only after the Torah is given, not before the Torah is given. Whatever. I mean, the details are less relevant, and this is the kind of discussion that ensues about how the Jewish people dealt with the darkness. And clearly, it was miraculous. In the area of Goshen itself, there was no darkness whatsoever. And when a Jew went into the area where there was darkness, it seems conceivable that maybe they had to bring their own lanterns along. But how the lantern worked in an atmosphere that didn't allow photonic activity, I don't know. Like I said, how you could even be in such an area, I don't know. According to what we assume about a black hole, then all of Egypt should have been swallowed up. So it probably can't be a black hole in the fullest sense. All I'm saying is that scientific language, which we really have a hard time understanding, like we wrap our heads around it in today's day and age, there's room to talk like this. This is the kind of business was talked about 3,300 years ago. And if you'll say, but they didn't understand it, I'll tell you, scientists don't understand this either.
Quantum mechanics, they don't understand.
Quantum mechanics of dark matter is not understood. We don't get that. Now, the truth is, this is very hard to understand. There is a medrash that describes the depth of the, it says it was thick. So there's a medrash that says that kama haya oisa cheshech, how thick was it? It says, avik a dinar, as thick as like a dinar. We know a dinar. Dinar was still found today. Like every once in a while, they unearth some old coins. It's a little thicker than the coins we have. That's like the thickness. So, of course, what does this mean? So David Luria wants to say like this. He says there's a halacha in Hilchos Treifos that says that if an animal is missing certain inner organs, the animal is not kosher. And that's why when we shecht an animal, we have to check to make sure that the innards are actually in place. But if certain parts of the animal are diminished, it's still a kosher animal. Because even a human being could live sometimes with a diminished liver. A human being could live with a diminished spleen. You can live with less density, with a smaller amount. So the minimum amount in an animal, it says, in the Steierberg, dinner zov, if it has at least the reality of a dinner zov, that's already good enough. So the Reb David Luria is suggesting that the Medrash's terminology is just halachic terminology. It meant that it was mamash, that it was mamashut. It wasn't nothing. There was something real. Like in Yiddish, there's an expression, vogik, weighty. It was weighty. It was something real. That's the meaning of this darkness. The Torah Tamimah says a very strange thing, and like he's not very well accepted. He says that they grew cataracts. You all have little like coins over their eyes, which doesn't make any sense. Like it doesn't fit with anything else it says. It fits with this medrash of a dinner, but they couldn't get up because they had a cataract. But like, it just first 3 days, second 3 days, vayomesh. It doesn't fit. Like it doesn't work. There is a very unusual book, which is called Chachmat Shlomo. Why is this book unusual? Well, this book is unusual because the Ramban writes about this book in his commentary, in his introduction to the commentary, that this is a collection of the wisdom, Chuchmasa Rabsa de Shlomo Malka. This is the collection of Solomon's wisdom. It's not written in Hebrew, by the way. It's written in Aramit. But if you remember last week's class, that's not a problem. We've been speaking Aramit since the days of Avraham Avinu. He came from Aram. That was the two languages he spoke. We talked about that last week. Anyway, it was only translated and printed in Hebrew something like in 1780. It's the first time it actually appeared in Hebrew. Some guy named Wiesel. I don't know if it's Elie Wiesel's grandfather. But some guy named Wiesel actually translated this Aramaic book into Hebrew, and it's called Chachma Shleime. And there's a lot of unusual things there. So the Chachma Shleime is quoted by a sefer called Ksava Kabbalah. He says, what's going on over here with this dark matter? He said, if the atmosphere changed, how could they have breathed? What's a good question? I don't know the answer. Like I'm using terminology like dark holes and black dark matter, negative matter. But the truth is, how did they breathe? And we know Ralbag says they closed their nose. Well, that doesn't really help us. Because if you close your nose, close your mouth for a week, like he says, so the inky darkness shouldn't go into their nose. Well, how we don't exactly know how this worked. So in the Sefer Chachma Shlomo, it says that during the time of Makat Choshech, and I quote, Vayishmu Vayiv Halu Miyoid, he says, there was strange sounds going on. They heard blood-curling sounds. Vayechredu, they were terrified. Mitmunat Zarot, they were showed the strangest images. Ki Hamachba Ashenechbu Bo, Lo Shamartem Levetach. They felt unsafe in their homes. This is like the original haunted house. Ach kolot shonot homus vivoteim lahafchidam. The craziest shrieking and blood-curling sounds, umalachim roim and evil angels, zayv ibanim with horrific-looking faces, nidu lamay were appeared to them. Basically, the Chachma Shlomo says that during this period of Choshech, the Egyptians are scared out of their wits. They were absolutely terrified. So the Ksava Kabbalah, he has a really hard time with this dark matter. And he says, I don't get it. And his questions are good questions. We don't have the answers. So what did they breathe? He doesn't say how did they exist because he doesn't know about annihilation. He's writing 200 years ago. So he says, I think maybe with the Chachma Shlomo we could say that they were so scared they couldn't move. They were scared stiff. They were afraid to move, afraid to do anything, because they heard these sounds and they saw like ghosts, and like they were absolutely freaked out. Now, I think Yasmin is a bit of a stretch to say that they didn't move for 3 days. The guy was standing, it was like frozen, and the person who was sitting couldn't get up because they were terrified. That's a little funny. It doesn't answer the question any better than saying Hashem made some kind of miraculous transformation in the atmosphere, and that's Makas Choshech. And you know what? Maybe this answers the original question too. The question we started with is, how come Moshe didn't give Paro a warning? What was he supposed to tell him? How is he going to describe what's going to happen? You're going to have darkness? Pharaoh will say, ha! We'll have candles. No. It's going to be thick darkness. Oh, thick darkness now. Very nice. Thank you very much, Moshe. I think you'd take a vacation because now you're getting a little crazy. What was Moshe supposed to say? Think about it. He was talking about darkness. Nobody knew what he was talking about. Because when we speak about darkness, what do we think about? The kind of darkness of night. And clearly, that had nothing to do with Makas Choshech. So I'm just saying, maybe it gives us a little bit of more of an understanding of why he couldn't warn him, because even if he warned him, he wouldn't understand what he was saying. And really, perhaps that's what we read before from the Balei HaTesvos, the Moshe Zakenim said. He said, I'll go back to his words, we start off, we said, Miktsas Hadavar, Lefisha Gila, Miktsas Hadavar, Lachain, Lo, Nichtava. Because he only told him something, he didn't give him the whole story, so it's not written, because actually what he warned them with, or whatever they heard about, and whatever happened, was totally divorced one from another. There were two different realities. He told them the Nile's going to turn into blood. The blood was blood. Plasma is plasma. That's what it was. Frogs are frogs, or amphibious, whatever it is, whether they're crocodiles or alligators, I don't know, but whatever it was, amphibious creatures that came out of the water, that's what it was. Lice are lice. Wild animals are wild animals. Yes, the hail, he said, is going to come down. He didn't tell them the hail's going to come with fire inside, by the way. He just said, hail's going to come. In fact, fire came too. Like I talked about on Shabbos, that served as a big lesson. That was like a teaching lesson for the Pharaoh. But he never warns him of that, actually. Think about it. If it's going to come with fire, why doesn't he say anything? Why? Because the Pharaoh never heard of it. He wouldn't know what he's talking about. He told the Pharaoh things the Pharaoh could relate to, the Pharaoh could get scared by. He's going to tell him, you're going to have darkness that's going to be what? So he told him darkness, but whatever he warned was not a warning. And therefore, like the Moshe Zakenim says, there's no point in saying it altogether. And that's a little bit of light shed on the darkness.